Venezuela is Russia's closest ally in South America. Or at least it was until January 3rd, when the U.S. military, you may have heard, captured President Nicolas Maduro in an operation that reportedly killed dozens of people. Today, Maduro is being held in a New York City jail on weapons and drug trafficking charges, while U.S. President Donald Trump has announced plans for American companies to take over Venezuela's oil industry. At first glance, Trump's intervention in Venezuela might look like an obvious disaster for Vladimir Putin. Russia has lost a key partner, and the prospect of Venezuelan oil flooding the market could push down prices even further, tightening the squeeze on Moscow's ability to fund its war against Ukraine. Then there's the embarrassing contrast between the U.S. operation in Caracas, which was over an hour, and Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, which Putin reportedly expected to last 3 days, but is now entering its fifth year. But my guests today paint a more complicated picture of what Trump's moves in Venezuela mean for Russia, global oil markets, and the world order. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. Hi, I'm Sam Brazil, senior news editor at Medusa in English, and you're listening to The Naked Pravda. To begin this episode, I spoke with Seva Gunitsky, a political science professor at the University of Toronto. Our conversation was inspired by a Substack article he published just hours after Maduro's capture, titled "Venezuela is a Gift to Putin." In it, he argues that Trump's operation in Venezuela promotes Putin's vision of the world and may even embolden Putin to ramp up sabotage and hybrid warfare in Europe. I asked Gunitsky to make the case for why Maduro's ouster could have concrete benefits for Putin and what it suggests about the new global order that's taking shape. Later in the show, I speak with Craig Kennedy, a Russian oil industry expert at Harvard's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, about what a U.S. takeover of Venezuela's oil sector could mean for Russia's war chest. Could you start by briefly laying out the argument for why this Venezuela operation would be good for Putin? If somebody came to you and said, obviously this is bad for Putin, his friend has been deposed, what's the counterargument?
Yeah, so sure. I think to answer that, I think we have to look at the kind of world Putin has said he wants to see. And what has he been demanding for 20 years now? And I think that answer is completely uncontroversial. And that's the end of the American liberal order. All these constricting liberal pieties about sovereignty and national self-determination and norms and rules and all of that. So I think at least since the Munich speech in 2007, he's kind of demanded and pushed for a multipolar world where great powers basically get to do what they want in their near abroad with impunity, with no sanctions. And that is exactly what he's getting with Trump. So in that sense, like I said in my piece, Trump's actions in Venezuela and Greenland now and elsewhere are a gift to Putin's vision of the world. And, you know, we can talk about the hypocrisies of the liberal order and how it wasn't actually orderly or whatever. I've done that myself. But it's hard to deny that Trump is taking American foreign policy in a different direction. And that direction, I think, aligns with and legitimizes Putin's view of what the global order should look like. That is the gift. Now, does that automatically translate into Putin having a sphere of influence? No. But like I say, I think it legitimizes his treatment of Europe as basically a playground for sabotage and interference and political influence. And it signals kind of an implicit bargain. You do what you want in your backyard. I mean, backyard in quotes, obviously. I do what I want in mine. Sam Green was a Russia scholar who I'm sure you know. He called it sort of spheres of condoned intervention. The idea being that we accept might makes right as long as you stay on your side of the fence. And as he pointed out, if that's what it takes to keep Europe and the U.S. out of the post-Soviet space, that's attractive to Putin. And I would also add, if that's what it takes to keep the U.S. out of Europe, that's also attractive. That's the world order Putin has said he wants. So the fact that Trump's actions are creating this anti-liberal order that he's demanded is, I think, inarguable. The real question is, okay, you got what you wanted, now what? Can Putin, as head of a declining power, take advantage of this gift? Or, you know, does he find himself overtaken by these forces that he wanted unleashed? And to me, that would be the great irony, if he finally got the thing he wanted and it turned out to be a curse. I hope it does.
Russia's GDP is tiny. It's smaller than Italy's. Why is Russia always assumed to be one of the hegemons that are going to be carving up the world in this possibly emerging new order.
So this is a very important objection, I think, that Russia is truly much weaker than China and the U.S. Why does it get to be in the hegemon club? Mm-hmm. And part of the answer is that Russia compensates for its lack of material power with political will, what I called agentic power in the piece. Putin is willing to do what other countries of similar size are not willing to do. He's willing to have a million casualties for Ukraine. He's willing to break the rules that others in Europe still abide by. He's not worried about his voters either. He has subdued internal unrest. And if anything, he's probably more worried about a palace coup from the hardliners than protests from anti-war citizens. So he's got a, you know, pliant population. He's got a nuclear umbrella. He only has to worry about external costs, not domestic costs. And I think that does, I think, raise the bar on what Russia is able to do, which is to punch above its material weight. But I think there's another factor here, which is currently inflating Russia's position in the world, and that is Trump's treatment of Russia. Because Trump seems to equate Putin's autocratic strength with national strength, which I think leads him to overlook some of Russia's structural weaknesses. Now, that might change, of course, knowing Trump, but right now he treats Russia and he sees Russia as a peer great power, and that means it deserves allowances in its region. So the objection that Russia is too weak, I think, to some extent mixes up material capacity with Russian policy or Putin's intent. Putin thinks Russia deserves a sphere, and Trump has done very little to disabuse him of that. Now, again, if Trump turns on Putin or if Europe steps up, which I hope they do, Putin's options shrink. But it will not happen because Russia is weak, short of collapse. It will happen due to external factors, especially European resolve. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, like, the claim is not that Russia will conquer Europe. Like, spheres of influence operate through things like intimidation, through political interference, as Russia has done with European far-right parties, for example. Through subversion, through propaganda, it's not just occupation. The question is not really, you know, can Putin take Berlin? No, but what does he think he can get away with now, given Trump's actions and given EU's response or non-response so far? And because part of Russia's advantage vis-a-vis Europe is just the non-functionality of the EU foreign policy apparatus. There has not been enough push to get tough to establish deterrence. A friend of mine on Twitter, Jasmine Mujanovic, put it, yeah, Russia is a third-rate power, but Europe is a paper tiger. Mm-hmm. I hope this changes. And I think we might be seeing some of that coming out of Germany, for example. There are reports that Chancellor Merz really wants to take on the Ukraine situation and, you know, make Germany's resolve clear to Putin. I hope that happens. I've gotten some responses from my article accusing me of, like, trying to justify Trump's actions or give Russia a win. No, I mean, look, the best outcome would be for Europe to deny Putin's growing ambitions and to prove me wrong. And yes, Russia is weak, and I suspect its economic situation will only get worse this year. But the point is, the legitimacy of the spheres of influence logic does not depend on how strong ruble is. If Putin sees Europe as helpless and as weak and as abandoned by the U.S., which it now very much seems to be, then he'll keep treating it as playground for sabotage. And that belief only breaks if Europe pushes back, not through internal Russian decay.
How much does this all depend on Trump, and how concrete is this gift that Putin is supposedly getting? In other words, can he do something now that he couldn't have otherwise, now that the sort of global political atmosphere has changed? Is that the idea?
Yeah. It's a very good question, because, like, the skeptical version of your question is, like, is this just vibes, right? So
yeah,
Putin sees Trump acting like a great power bully and he feels validated, but so what? What actually changes? Well, I think a few things change concretely. First, the risk calculus. Well, Putin is always probing, testing to see what he can get away with. I think that's fairly uncontroversial. So if Trump is willing to do this in Venezuela and face no pushback, what signal does that send about American commitments to, say, Lithuania or Poland? And look, these are, of course, NATO members, but look at what NATO is doing right now. Their main worry is the U.S. possibly invading a NATO ally in Greenland. So what kind of a signal does that send to Putin about American commitment to NATO or to the EU? And, you know, you did mention that, you know, Trump is volatile and can change his mind. And I've heard that a lot, that people say Trump doesn't have a vision for the global order. Well, I mean, Look, I mean, I'm sure he doesn't sit in the Oval Office reading Kissinger, but he's been very consistent in saying the U.S. should stop providing for European security. So again, the question is, do U.S. actions to places like Greenland signal reduced commitment? And in doing so, do they change Putin's risk calculus? And again, keep in mind that for Trump, Russia is a peer great power deserving the allowances in this region, like I said. You can see that in how he treats the Russia-Ukraine conflict, that Russia must be given certain accommodations. So it's the permission structure that Trump is creating for Putin. Mm. Now, if the U.S. explicitly embraces spheres of influence logic and stops being the EU's security guarantor, I think it's plausible to say that Putin would read that as, I guess, expanded operating space. This is not a hypothetical, by the way. We have precedents for this, right? So many, like, think about Syria. Many analysts think, not all, but I think a lot of analysts think that Obama's signals about Syria in 2013 also affected Putin's risk calculus. Like, so the U.S. was not really going to be hawkish. And he invaded Crimea the next year. I mean, he did that for a number of reasons, but paying attention to U.S. signaling is part of that calculation. And let me just sort of do a caveat here. These signals can also be misinterpreted, leading to dumb choices. It doesn't have to make Putin into some strategic genius. You know, Putin's mode has always been to probe through the mush until he hits steel, you know, to borrow the Lenin quote. And when there's more mush, he'll keep digging deeper. And we've already seen this since Trump came into office. I mentioned in my piece that Russian sabotage operations in Europe have, you know, skyrocketed over the past year. That's not hypothetical. He is already treating Europe as a gray zone, and so far nothing in Trump's behavior suggests he'll face any consequences for it. I think that is a meaningful difference.
You said earlier that we're talking about an increase in hybrid warfare against Europe, not necessarily a Russian occupation or invasion of NATO territory or something like that. But I sort of tend to imagine that the increase in Russian hybrid operations over the last year is always kind of meant to probe and prepare for some kind of potential invasion. Do you think there is such a risk? Or what other benefits might Russia get from these acts of sabotage?
My instinct is to say no. Right now, a full-scale invasion is unlikely. Russia is just really bogged down in Ukraine. And besides, you know, sabotage or buying off far-right politicians, that's pretty cheap and pretty low risk compared to an invasion. And that's another reason, by the way, why Russian weakness doesn't matter as much here. But I do hear this argument, you know, if Russia is so overstretched militarily, why is Poland so concerned? Why are the Baltics so concerned about future invasions? What would, you know, Russia even use for another war? And that's fine, but it's kind of like saying, you know, they're not dumb enough to do this, are they? Like, would they really provoke another war, given everything else? And it's a legitimate question, but, you know, that exact same question, are they dumb enough to do it, was asked a lot before the February 22 invasion. And a lot of people said, no, there's no way Russia's dumb enough to do this. I mean, Galliotti said this, Lawrence Friedman said this. We can go down a very long list of experts who said, no way, too dumb. But, you know, here we are. And I think actions by Russian security forces have become kind of so untethered from any idea of national interest, use that in heavy quotes, that I can't really say with confidence they would not try to expand the conflict, either out of sheer hubris or stupidity or an accident, I don't know. He's also in an information bubble. Like, dictators don't get good data. We know that Belousov is lying at least in part about the war, right? If Putin is told by his yes men that the Baltics, oh yeah, they'll fold in 48 hours, he might invade. Again, not because he's crazy or stupid, but because, you know, his system is increasingly incapable of producing accurate risk assessments. Mm. And this is not unique to Russia, by the way. This is very common in history. You know, Stalin was convinced that Hitler would never be dumb enough to start a two-front war. That's why he didn't mobilize ahead of Barbarossa. And I guess in the end, Stalin was right, but he paid a lot for that assumption, which is countries do stupid things, especially when their leaders are disconnected from the population and disconnected in some ways from reality. How do you deter that? That's hard.
Right, yeah. When I think of Putin's information bubble, I always think, like, that's great. He doesn't know what's going on in Ukraine. He's going to mess up. But yeah, it could go the other way too.
Recklessness can be helpful in the sense that it makes them do stupid things, but it can also mean that it's very hard to deter or predict what he's going to do.
So back to Venezuela, what are the ramifications of Maduro's ouster for Putin? You know, on the negative side, how bad is it that Putin won't have Venezuela on his side anymore.
Well, I mean, like I said in the piece, part of this is obviously embarrassing for Russia. You saw how angry the war bloggers got when it happened. Yeah. You know, where did all our money go? Why are we giving support to these allies who can't do anything? I think a lot of that is just a little bit of jealousy, not really outrage at American lawlessness, but just jealous that they weren't able to do the same thing. As you know, and many others have pointed out, Russia tried to do something very similar in the opening phase of the invasion and failed. But the point is not that it's, you know, an unalloyed good for Russia. There are obvious costs from America's actions in Venezuela. I think that part is obvious. The costs are real. The question is, what is the precedent worth? Putin is not really in the business of defending Venezuela's honor. He's in the business of getting the U.S. to accept spheres of influence as the operating logic of world politics. And that's the principle now being established. And if this is how the world works now, what can Putin get away with in Moldova or the Baltics or Georgia and so on?
It feels like the global order is really up in the air right now. Maybe Europe is waking up a bit to the lack of protection it can count on from the United States. How much of a turning point do you think this Venezuela operation might be?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a very tough question because, you know, like, what are we doing here? Like, everybody's arguing about the global order because it's so up in the air. Now, there's a couple of things happening here. First of all, Trump is a bully in the sense that he attacks the weak and fears the strong. He's also a big fan of transnational kleptocracy, money flowing across these great powers. So both of these factors, I think, mitigate against great power competition as the key framework for explaining U.S.-Russian relations. But as you say, things are up in the air. If Trump sours on Putin, or if there's a pro-NATO Democrat in 28, you know, assuming we have elections and everything goes well, then we could be back to great power competition as a primary framework for Russia-U.S. relations. And of course, by the way, I should add, great power concert and great power competition are not mutually exclusive. You can have basic agreements on spheres, but still compete. So I guess my broader goal in writing that piece kind of alludes to what you're asking, which is what is really going on in the world today. And the goal was to push back against the idea of great power competition as, you know, the default framework that we have to adopt as the liberal order declines. That term, I think, in some ways doesn't quite capture what's going on. It's not just Cold War 2.0. I think that's too simple. There's elements of it, sure, but there are also other elements at play that go beyond great power competition. And again, that's the gift he's getting from Trump. Whether he can take advantage of that, I think, is a different story, but, you know, he got his wish.
Next, my conversation with Russia oil industry expert Craig Kennedy. Could you start by kind of laying out the significance of the new Western sanctions on Russian oil that took effect in November to kind of set the scene for the Venezuela developments that we'll talk about?
So the oil sanctions in November actually consisted of three different discrete actions, but really one captured the headlines, and that was when Washington announced that it was going to sanction the production coming out of Russia's two largest oil producers, Rosneft and Lukoil. And when you add this to the fact that early in 2025, OFAC in Washington had also sanctioned production coming from two smaller producers, Surgut Neftigaz and Gazprom Neft. When you add it all up together, it comes to about 80% of Russia's total output, which basically means that 80% of the oil that's being produced by Russia is subject to sanctions, and anybody who buys it is potentially at risk of secondary sanctions from Washington. So, for example, if you are a refiner in Russia and you buy oil from Gazprom Neft, you refine it and you sell it to Russian citizens, both you and the buyers, the citizens, are theoretically subject to sanctions from Washington. But those buyers aren't particularly concerned about that because they are all operating within Russia, well beyond the reach of U.S. sanctions. However, Russia exports more than two-thirds of its total production. And so anybody abroad who's buying Russian oil will be concerned about the fact that some 80% of Russia's production is subject to sanctions. So if you're, for example, a refiner in Turkey or a refiner in India or even China, you're going to be asking the question, is this cargo of oil coming out of Russia that I'm buying and I intend to refine, is that cargo or those barrels subject to U.S. sanctions? And so this suddenly raises a lot more risk for those refiners about buying Russian oil, because so much of it now is subject to sanctions. And if somebody from Washington gives you a call and says, we're concerned that you're buying Russian oil that we've put sanctions on, you do realize that you rely on your U.S. dollar account, for example, to conduct business internationally. That could be at risk. We'd like to ask you to respect the sanctions that we put in place, since you benefit from the services we provide as a major currency of the industry. And that creates a dilemma for these buyers. Do we take the risk that we could lose access to the U.S. dollar and buy the Russian oil, or do we decide we're going to stop buying Russian oil? Or can we figure out some way to find that 20% of Russian production that's not yet subject to sanctions? And how do we prove that that's clean oil and not oil which is subject to sanctions? So these are all the difficult issues that big refiners in India in particular are tangling with at this point, because they don't want to get on the wrong side of the U.S. Treasury on the one hand, because they're a big exporting nation of refined product. They rely very much on Western services, and it's not just the U.S. dollar they rely on. When they refine Russian oil and they put it onto tankers to send back to Europe or to send elsewhere in the world, the tankers they're putting it onto are almost invariably insured by the big international insurance groups for the oil business based in Europe. And so those insurers themselves also are saying, look, we got to make certain that you're not dealing in sanctioned Russian oil. If you are buying sanctioned Russian oil and then shipping refined products to Europe on vessels we're insuring, we can't insure you anymore. So they're at risk of getting in trouble with the U.S. over the dollar. They're at risk of getting in trouble with Brussels and London over insurance. And then finally, there's a third thing that has happened, and the Europeans have said, and by this I include both the UK and Brussels, they've done something called closing the refining loophole. What they're saying to refiners around the world is, if you buy Russian oil, any Russian oil, whether it's sanctioned or not, if you're buying Russian oil and you're bringing it into the port where your refinery gets its crude from, so say the port of Sikka in India is where the giant Reliance oil company or oil refining complex gets its crude imported to. They refine it and then they stick it right back on tankers and ship it out to the rest of the world as diesel and other refined product. What Europe is now saying is you got to wait 60 days between receiving a shipment of Russian oil and loading any product for export back to Europe. Otherwise, we won't accept that exported product. So that's creating yet another dilemma for these refiners. They want to buy Russian oil because it's cheap. It's cheap because Russia is struggling to find people who are willing to buy it. So it's just a simple supply-demand thing. There's just not enough demand for this problematic oil, so you've got to give a big discount. But if you're an Indian refiner today, you're asking yourself, first of all, is this part of that 80% that's sanctioned right now by OFAC? Second of all, if I feel comfortable it's clean Russian oil unsanctioned, you know, do I want to sell some of the products back to Europe? Because Europe is the biggest importer of refined products. They have premium prices. I love selling to Europe, right? But I've got to wait 60 days on a continual basis between when I load or when I receive Russian oil and when I can ship product out to Europe. So unless that Russian oil is really cheap, it's not worth my while to lose access to the European market. So all these things are putting crushing pressure on the Russian oil price. And that, of course, feeds right back to Moscow's pocket. The Kremlin coffers are seeing some of the lowest incomes from some of the deepest discounts on Russian oil that we've seen since the start of the hostilities, you know, full-scale invasion in 2022.
Have there been signs of a major shut-in of Russian oil yet? Meaning, has Russia had to suspend oil production?
Not a major one, but we've definitely seen a significant contraction in total liquids being exported from Russia since late last year. And it varies quite a bit week by week. Weather patterns can affect it, but it does look as though we've seen at least a 10% contraction in total volumes, perhaps more. And that almost certainly is translating into some limited production shut-ins. But what they've been doing is they've been finding every tanker they can possibly get their hands on, loading it up and getting it out on the water, because given a choice, they'd rather have oil coming up out of the ground and just sitting around in a tanker waiting for the day when they might be able to sell it, rather than having to shut it in. Because if you shut it in, then you have bigger technical issues with the field, especially if you do it on an emergency basis in the dead of winter.
And now I want to ask you about the likely consequences of a Trump takeover of the Venezuelan oil industry. The picture I have in my head is that before this, at least, Russia's dirty oil on the shadow fleet ships and everything was competing with Iranian oil and Venezuelan oil for sellers who were willing to buy the sanctioned oil. Is that the case?
Yeah. So you've set it up nicely, Sam. Before the, I guess we're calling them the November 2025 sanctions, the volume sanctions on the new sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil. Before then, Russia really wasn't in direct competition with Venezuela and Iran for markets, because most of the world, not most of the world, but pretty much all of the non-EU G7 markets were open to Russia still. You could sell to Turkey, you could sell to India, you could sell to pretty much all of China, and Russia did. So, and that was enough to absorb what Russia was pushing out into the marketplace without too deep a discount. Iran, by contrast, and Venezuela were under enough pressure from the U.S. in particular that there was really only one big market that they could sell their oil into, and that's the Shandong province refineries in China. Now, these are sometimes called the teapot refineries. Basically, if you think of China as, you know, 10 or 11 million barrels a day of imports. Most of those are going to big state-run oil companies with global footprints, interests abroad, they export stuff as well. And they often buy from, you know, big Western trading houses or big Western producers. They really don't want to get involved with sanctioned oil from Iran or Venezuela and get in, and have trouble with OFAC. So that takes out 3/4 of Russia, of Chinese imports. But there's this small group of independent refiners who really don't have an international footprint. They buy oil abroad from abroad, import oil, and then they refine it domestically and sell it domestically. And then they find ways to sort of pay for it through various third channels, avoiding the dollar. So in the case of Russia, for example, there's enough of a counter trade between, or bilateral trade between the yuan and the ruble that they can settle directly with Russia through yuans and rubles. So what's been happening is there's a quota on how much these teapot refiners can import, but it's been enough to take in, say, 1.5 million barrels a day from Iran, another 500,000 barrels a day from Venezuela. The problem now is that with all of this Russian oil under sanctions, Russia needs part of that Shandong quota to keep its exports whole. And so it's suddenly in competition with Iran and Venezuela for that limited market share of refiners who are happy to buy sanctioned oil in large quantities, although they prefer it when you kind of tried to use a bit of subterfuge to hide the origin of the oil. it's 2.5 million barrels a day. It's not enough to fix Russia's problem alone, but it's an important part of the fix. And the irony here is that with Venezuela now agreeing with the U.S., it appears, to start shipping large amounts of Venezuelan oil to the U.S., where it used to go anyway, and where there are lots of refineries that are specifically designed to manage the heavy sour crudes coming out of Venezuela, that suddenly opens up capacity in Shandong for Russia to move more of its oil into. So in that respect, it's actually a good thing for Russia, because it'll make it easier for it to find more demand for sanctioned barrels or problematic barrels. It's not going to totally change the game, though, and they're still competing head-on against the Iranians, who are by far and away the larger of the exporters. But nonetheless, it helps a bit on the margins.
I've actually written about the Shadow Fleet. I've seen Shadow Fleet ships, but I don't actually have a good idea of what percentage of Russian oil exports are transported by these ships. What's the actual share?
Okay, so first of all, there's understandably a lot of confusion about the Shadow Fleet. I mean, they wouldn't call it the Shadow Fleet if it were completely transparent, right? But if you really do a lot of granular analysis of what's going on, you soon come to the conclusion that it's best to think about the Shadow Fleet as two separate Shadow Fleets. You have the traditional Shadow Fleet that was around before 2022, primarily servicing Iran and Venezuela. They do a little bit in Syria, a little bit in North Korea as well. But really, it was there mostly for Iran and Venezuela. A lot of old rust bucket ships that should have been sent to the shipyards long ago, et cetera. Then in the spring of 2022, the Kremlin suddenly realizes that the Europeans are upset about this invasion of Ukraine, upset enough that they might not simply say, we don't want to buy your oil anymore, but you can no longer use our ships or our insurance to export to third countries. And so they get really anxious and say, we need to build up our own Shadow Fleet capacity. It's quickly apparent to them that simply trying to poach vessels from Iran's Shadow Fleet isn't going to work, in part because many of those vessels are the wrong size. They're what's called VLCCs, very large crude carriers. It's the biggest standard tanker out there, 2 million barrels of oil. The problem is they're so large, you can't get them through either the Danish Straits or the Turkish Straits laden with oil. And that's where 75% of Russia's exports flow through. So first of all, they're just the wrong tanker. Second of all, Iran's busy with them. Iran needs them, and Venezuela needs them. And thirdly, they're pretty unreliable. They kind of, you know, carry a load, then they hang out for a while in the Rao archipelago doing God knows what, right? So Russia quickly realizes we have to buy our own fleet. And they send out agents, and they compile a massive fleet of vessels. They acquire over 400 distinct vessels through various agents, that many of which had been in the mainstream fleet, but then immediately get renamed, reflagged, and their insurance through the European International Group of Insurers, that gets cut off. And they put in place central bank insurance. And this covers quite a bit of Russia's needs, but not the total amount. At one point, they're able to maybe manage 70-75% of their exports. There's a big secondary market. And the way it works for the tanker markets is that tankers generally have about a 20-year service life. And that service life is dictated in part by a series of increasingly stringent mandatory ship hull surveys that happen every 5 years. And it's under International Maritime Organization agreements. It's a UN agreement. And everybody actually buys into this pretty effectively, because you don't want a ship coming into your port that hasn't been properly inspected. And as ships get older, hull fatigue sets in. And by the time you get to 20 years and they're up for their 20-year inspection, it's very expensive to make certain that your vessel's still in good shape. And so most vessels get retired at that point and sent off to the ship breaking yards. But the big Western fleets will sell their vessels off at age 15, 16, 17 to smaller operators who sort of milk them for a few more years. And that is the source of most of the vessels for the Shadow Fleet. That's where Russia has acquired most of these tankers from. And usually it's, you know, arm's length transactions, third party, Middle Eastern based buyers, et cetera. All of it is sort of kept offshore, no Russian flags, no Russian fingerprints. But it's obvious what's happening because as soon as they're purchased, they stop calling it any other port in the world except Russian ports, and it's 24/7 Russia. But the problem is these are aging vessels. And so through a combination of attrition and now sanctions, Russia has lost almost 50% of the capacity that it had acquired through the Shadow Fleet. And so they're now down to about managing around 50% of their total exports using mainstream vessels and 50% using Shadow Fleet ships. So they're still heavily reliant. In fact, their reliance has been increasing on Western ships, which is why they're so anxious. Because what if somebody suddenly says, hey, we're going to impose a full maritime services ban on Russia? That would be disastrous for Russia.
Just on Wednesday, the day before we're speaking, the U.S. Coast Guard seized a Russian-flagged ship. What happened there, and do you think it'll change Moscow's calculations regarding the Shadow Fleet, or is it just kind of a dramatic moment that we're going to forget about? What does it mean?
Here's what I think is happening, and bear with me, and I'm hoping to put something out on this very shortly. So the ship that was taken yesterday, the Bella One, now called a Marinera, it's a VLCC to begin with. So it's a very large crude carrier. It's never lifted oil out of Russia. It has no connections with Russia, the Russian Shadow Fleet historically. It has been sanctioned by OFAC, but for its operations in respect to Iran, right? But what seems to have happened is this. Sometime late last year, Russia decided to try and get more involved in the Venezuelan oil trade. And when the blockade was formally announced by the U.S. in the middle of December, there were a number of ships that are part of the Russian Shadow Fleet, or in the case of the Bella One, were approaching Venezuela, and the Bella One is turned away, or it turns away, and suddenly the U.S. is in pursuit of it. And if you listen closely to what's being said out of Moscow, this vessel gets reflagged during hot pursuit. It not only gets reflagged, but it gets sold at the end of December to a company based in Russia. And its survey gets re-registered to the Russian Maritime Registry, which is Russia's official ship surveyor. So in other words, you were taking a big tanker with ties to Iran that's being pursued by the U.S. across the Atlantic, and you're doing everything possible to signal Russian claims on this. I mean, it's like running up a giant flashing neon Russian flag. It's not just the flag itself, it's ownership, it's surveys, it's everything. So Russia clearly wanted to signal, this is ours, ruki proch, don't touch, right? But that's not the only vessel they did this with. There are several others as well that were around Venezuela, which had closer connections with Russia, which they suddenly decided to reflag and signal very strongly, this is Russian property. So the question is, why are they doing this? Now, one speculation is that, well, maybe they were smuggling arms, and you know, this is a way of trying to stop the U.S. from boarding the ship and discovering the arms. But it doesn't seem that any arms had been discovered. And the ship actually had been in the Persian Gulf for many months before it set sail for Venezuela. So it's conceivable they could have gotten arms onto it there. But there doesn't seem to be an arms connection, at least in the case of the Bella One yet. Could still emerge that there was. I think the more likely thing is this. Russia saw a standoff emerging between Venezuela and the U.S. And whenever they see a standoff, the first question they ask is, how can we get involved in a way that will give us leverage, that will create a bargaining chip for us that we can trade? And the best thing to do is to say, you know what? Maduro needs ships that he can use to run the U.S. blockade. If we stick a bunch of Russian flags on ships and dare the U.S. to stop them, then if the U.S. blinks, we'll have a very powerful bargaining chip because we will have broken the U.S. blockade. We'll have given Maduro a way to keep his oil flowing. And then Washington will have to come to us to trade that for maybe some concessions around Ukraine. So in other words, it's typical Moscow spoiler behavior. You see a conflict, you think, how can I step in and do something to create an advantage for myself? It's exactly what they've done. And not only that, but they've made it clear in their statements, a senior advisor to Putin, a former member of the Russian foreign ministry, has said as much that, you know, suddenly five tankers have declared themselves to be Russian. We will see an attack on any of these ships as an attack on Russia, and this will complicate things greatly for Washington. So they put a red line down by painting a Russian flag on the hull, but Washington has disregarded the red line, and that actually makes Moscow look weak.
You've painted a certain picture of Russia's economy, or at least its ability to fund the war, over the last year and in the coming year, but at least to a non-expert, it sounds similar to a lot of the headlines over the last 4 years. Russia's economy is about to collapse. Its war effort is going to run out of juice. Does it look like their ability to fund the war could really start slipping sometime soon?
So there is the collapse model that many people use for, you know, how long can Russia keep going? At what point does it collapse? And I think that's informed by various episodes in history, like the February Revolution of 1917, when suddenly there was this inflection point in the First World War and the domestic situation where there were bread riots on the street, government collapses suddenly, you know, 300 years of Romanov rule. So there's that collapse scenario, but I don't think that's the most likely scenario here. And I think it's the wrong model to apply. The better question to be asking is, does Moscow feel that time is on its side or not? And I think here you've got to look at several different, it's really several questions. On the battlefield, is time on our side? Maybe, but maybe not. I mean, they're making very slow progress and they're expending huge amounts of resources to do so. So it doesn't look as though there's any major breakthrough pending on the battlefield. Then you have the diplomatic front where there's been a lot more fluidity. And I think there they feel as though there may still be an opportunity to try and drive wedges and cut deals or whatever. And again, we come back to the whole Venezuelan situation, creating bargaining chips from the Venezuela situation that you can use elsewhere. But then there's the final question about the finances. And here, I think Moscow will have recognized over the course of 2025 that things are only going to get worse, or likely to only get worse for us on the planet. It'll become harder and harder for us to fund this war. We will be running more and more risks domestically. And it's becoming more and more apparent to our adversaries how weak our situation is. It's harder to hide. So I think the important question to ask is, at what point does Moscow decide time is no longer on our side? The longer we wait, the greater the risk that there's a blow up with the banks, that people get set up with having to pay higher and higher taxes. We can't afford to pay, you know, the kontraktniki, the soldiers, the same amount we could before, and they stop wanting to go and fight, you know, any number of things. And so the longer they wait, the greater the risk is. And I think on the finance side, they absolutely see that things are only going to get riskier from here on out. So unless there's a really compelling opportunity on the diplomatic front, they will start, or if we can convince them there is no major potential breakthrough on the diplomatic front, that they're going to be more compelled to try and find terms. But I don't think they're convinced of that yet.
Thanks for listening, folks. That's this week's show. As always, check out Meduza's homepage for our reporting on Russia, Ukraine, and the surrounding region. Share this podcast with your friends and enemies if you want. Write a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Until next time.